It's that time of the year. Your vacation is coming up. You can already hear the beach waves, feel the warm breeze, relax, and think about work. You really, really want it all to work out while you're away. Monday.com gives you and the team that peace of mind. When all work is on one platform and everyone's in sync, things just flow. Wherever you are, tap the banner to go to Monday.com.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/achieve today.
Everyone knows therapy is great for solving problems, but getting therapy has its own problems too, like finding the right therapist, fitting into their schedule, and of course, the cost. Well, BetterHelp can solve those problems. It's totally online and built around your schedule. It's surprisingly affordable too. Connect with a credentialed therapist by phone, video, or online chat, all from the comfort of your home. Visit betterhelp.com to learn more and save 10% on your first month. That's BetterHelp, H-E-L-P.
Welcome to Podcast Like It's 1992, the podcast where we talk about the films of 1992 here under Dr. Giggle's scalpel in 2023. I am your host, Philip Escobar, and with me today is writer Lewis Peitzman to talk with us about Dr. Giggles, everyone's favorite horror icon.
He's a horror icon, I think, of people who care about early 90s horror. Which is a very small subset of horror fans, probably.
When did you see Dr. Giggles for the first time, Lewis?
So I realized that, like, when I reached out and was like, yeah, I gotta do Dr. Giggles, you probably felt like this was like a childhood favorite. Yeah. But actually, I didn't watch this movie until earlier this year. I had heard about it. I heard about it first, like, 20 years ago. Like, this was like a mythic film to me, because I couldn't really believe there was a movie called Dr. Giggles. I remember the time being like, is it funny, is it scary? And I was like assured that it was actually very scary. I think maybe that was not that ended up not being the case, but I finally saw it this year, and then I obviously rewatched it to be super fresh for this podcast. I think you've mentioned this on the show before, that like 90s horror is a mixed bag, but most of the bag is like hot garbage. There just isn't a lot of, like, especially early 90s, like high quality horror to
At. It's very strange, because, like, first of all, you know, full disclosure, our listeners know this, I'm not a big horror guy. I was a big scaredy cat as a kid, so I, like, really didn't watch a lot of horror movies. I've subsequently, in my old age, discovered they're not that scary. Why are you so afraid of these movies? But that being said, I've slowly but surely been kind of, like, working my way to some of the, like, big mainstay kind of horror films that are...
Like Dr. Giggles.
Dr. Giggles, obviously. I mean, for instance, you know, for our Patreon, Kenny and I covered the Nightmare on Elm Street series, so I watched all those, and they're fucking great. Like, big fan of Freddy. He's such a stinker. He's great. So I kind of went into this one, and if I'm being completely honest, the thing that's always stayed with me about this movie is the poster. Because for our listeners who don't know, there is a Dr. Giggles poster, and it's essentially his eyes with him under, like, behind a surgical mask. And there's a scalpel in, like, the title, and, like, as a hypochondriac, as a child, this movie was like, stay the fuck away from Dr. Giggles. Like, why would I possibly subject myself to this? And then I pressed play on this movie and realized it's just campy. Right? Yeah. Like, it's pure camp.
Yeah. I mean, I think there is an element of it that is unsettling because, like,
sure,
a doctor that who kills you is like an unsettling concept. There's like medical instruments that are creepy, sure, and that's kind of scary unto itself, but I don't think that they were going for scary, but it, I mean, it's, yeah, it's, there was this sort of like genre of medical horror. You have like The Dentist, which is a more, I think, a little bit campy but a little bit more scary and certainly more violent in terms of showing, sure, you horrific dental procedures. Yeah, I mean, this, the tone of this movie is so bizarre that I, watching it again, I was like really trying to, I feel like part of it is that it was sort of, and I was trying to figure out the production, it was sort of like this and the comic book were at the same time because it was like part of a, yeah, deal with Dark Horse.
I should have looked up the comic. I didn't look, because like when the comic came out predates the movie, correct?
But it was the same month. So it wasn't like, okay, it wasn't like this was, okay, based on a comic. It was like they were a joint, but the movie is like, it has a comic book movie vibe. It and does. I think that is what I wasn't able to get the first time I watched it. Obviously every repeat viewing of Dr. Giggles unlocks more about
it's an this onion,
film.
Really. There's just layers and layers to it.
Yeah.
The comic book, which I'm looking at right now, he looks like Larry Drake, right?
Yeah,
like there's no question that these are kind of in concert with one another. And there is kind of this, and maybe this is just the dark man of it all, but like it did feel a little bit Raimi-esque, you know?
Yeah.
Like it definitely had that kind of Evil Dead-ish kind of horror vibe to it. Did you sense that?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's definitely going for that kind of vibe. I almost wish it were sillier. Like it has these,
yeah,
it opens with that scene after the amazing CGI of the, you know, bloodstream and red blood cells and heart. It like opens with Dr. Giggles escape from the mental hospital. And he has that, he's holding the doctor's arms that he cut off. And it's amazing. And they like look so obviously fake and it's not really meant to look real. And it's, that's like the tone it goes for. But the movie kind of like is also weirdly like a teen romantic drama, and that element doesn't quite feel like it fits with the comic book aspect, yeah, of like the Sam Raimi type like horror comedy. It's a bit of a weird combination. I kind of wonder if like someone's studio note was like, you gotta put in some like hot young actors to play teens in love.
Yeah, it has a very kind of almost Sydney and Billy vibe from Scream, right? Where it's like, you know, in this movie, Jennifer and Max, Jennifer seems pretty self-aware, pretty understanding of like the world that she's in. She's as sort of grounded and terrestrial as anybody is in this movie. And Max is just kind of a horny guy, essentially.
He's a terrible, terrible boyfriend.
Like he's a bad boyfriend.
A truly terrible boyfriend.
So much so that you're like, at the end, I'm like, I'm not rooting for these two. Like, get this fucking guy out of here. What are you doing, Jennifer? You saw him making out with somebody else. He's willing to throw you under the bus, basically, at any chance he gets. So, yeah, the love story is kind of bullshit in this. But I do kind of wonder if it's aware of how bullshit it is. Like, to your point that it's like, I'm just fulfilling a studio note type thing.
I don't think they were going for true romantic sincerity. I just think that like the way it's done is still a little bit, it's played straight a little bit,
yeah,
more than like the horror elements are.
Yeah, no, 100%. It's, you know, it's funny, as I was watching this, I was thinking of like, what would the David Cronenberg Dr. Giggles be? Because
it
like
would be it would be amazing.
It'd be amazing. Because like Cronenberg, you know, obviously big body horror guy. And he really understands how unsettling this vessel is, right? Like, that's his whole thing, is like, this thing that we live in is this weird, you know, decomposing flesh sack that we just kind of exist in. And I feel like this movie dips its toes into, at the very least, through the medical lane of like, pretty fucking crazy that we just let these people do these things to our bodies and we just put the trust that we have into these doctors. That in and of itself is a really compelling and interesting thing that I'm not sure the movie completely weaponizes, but does to some degree.
Yeah, I mean, there's definitely, I can see a Cronenberg version of this. I do think that this movie like is almost Canadian in vibe, so like that part of it certainly. And then yeah. Also we get like the toward the end Dr. Giggles like unveils more of his like medical instruments that are horrific, and it's similar to like Dead Ringers with the awful gynecological instruments. I mean, those are worse. That is that movie is not really a straight horror, but it's certainly more unsettling than Dr. Giggles.
Absolutely.
Which, you know, is there are some kills in this movie that I have a hard time watching just because it evokes, I mean, it just makes you think about like all the times you've had any sort of medical procedure, or even like, you know, when you're little and any sort of medical test seems scary, it taps into that, maybe by accident. But there's something there. I mean, there are some like moments that I don't love watching, namely the nasal probe kill. I find that one very hard to watch.
So this is the thing. I agree with you 100%. There's something very, I mean, let's be real. Dr. Giggles has one bit, and that bit is to use medical tools to fuck you up. It's a good bit, though, just to be
great
clear.
Bit.
Like,
great bit.
It's a really great bit. Strangling someone with a blood pressure cuff, for instance. Or, as you mentioned, this... I'm not sure that probe is meant to be a nasal probe.
Whatever it is. I know, it certainly... It went into her brain. No, I mean, like, it's... I honestly, like, the thing about that moment, though, is that it's one of the few deaths we actually see. I mean, the movie is, like, weirdly restrained. It has this, like, almost, like...
implications.
Like, like, TV edit version where you're not really... There are some really gory moments, but most of the weird medical stuff you actually don't see happen. Like, you sort of... It's implied. It's still very disgusting, but it's implied. And that one we just, like, see... fully what's happening, and it's rough. But even like the blood pressure thing is like, I think again it like taps into that feeling when you like have a blood pressure cuff on where you're like, this is too tight, it can't possibly get tighter, and then it keeps going and it's like, is this safe? I love the bit. I think it's a great bit. I think he's got, he has puns and he has creative kills. I almost like, I think there's a version of this movie also, like Cronenberg or not, that would like go much harder. Like it could be so much more disgusting and disturbing and still be a comedy, but it's like, it is kind of restrained.
You mentioned the gynecological tools, and as a side note, Cronenberg himself designed those tools and, has them in his house. My mother was friends with his wife and went to his house, and he literally has them on display throughout his house. So there you go. I think that there's just something so invasive about medical tools, right? Like, they're literally going in orifices. This idea of like all that kind of stuff, I think this movie could have, to your point, gone farther with. And I also feel too, where like it's not really playing in the realm of realism, which is intentional.
Right.
But had it played in the realm of realism, it would have been so much scarier. Like the tools that he unveils at the end of the movie, I'm just like, what? These tools would serve truly no purpose. They literally look like, I don't even know what they are. These they're just insane metal piercing objects, essentially, is what they are. And I know that that's part of the campiness of the movie, which I think is also an asset, right? Like, it's a choice. The movie is sort of playing with dials. But to your point, I think there's a spookier version of this, or a much more unsettling version of this, where it feels realer and thus it's scarier. This is pretty cartoonish. I mean, Larry Drake's performance in this film, the giggling is amazing and then also kind of annoying by the end of the movie.
The giggling is as promised. I think that you really get what you came for. It says it on the box. It says Dr. Giggles, and that's exactly what you get. I think that it's like a tough line to walk, but in terms of like the realism of it and trying to keep it kind of campy, but certainly if like what he was doing or the tools seem more like actual medical, that's why that nasal probe, whatever it was actually meant for, it feels a lot closer to like what something you would actually, you know, have used, the blood pressure cuff, all of that, versus like, you know, when he uses that weird spiky thing to kill the doctor at the end. That's a little bit different. I do love when he uses the reflex hammer thing. I like that. I don't know. I mean, I really, it's so, I really like want to know everything about how this movie came to be, because I feel like it's kind of like at times in a little bit of a battle with itself, where it's always silly, but it can't really decide how silly to be. It can't really decide how gross or scary to be. There's like a little bit of a back and forth there.
Yeah, you know, you mentioned the comic thing. I think it's worth kind of unpacking that for a second too, because it does feel like he feels like a Batman villain, right? Or a Spider-Man villain, as opposed to like a horror villain, if that makes sense.
Like, the green poison that he injects people with, I mean, that is like just like a classic comic book trope where you have to like make it green so we know it's bad. I don't know why that medication would be green, but you know,
we don't even know what these meds are that he's giving people, by the way. Like, it's we just know that it's bad. I mean, it's like when that old woman across the street, he swaps out her, is it a red pill for a blue pill or something like that?
Right.
Like it's so cartoonishly colored and large in the frame that it honestly feels like something, you know, straight out of a comic book. And I think I agree with you 100% that like the tonal kind of line this movie is trying to exist in, I think they probably thought it was safer to play campier than scarier, in the hopes of A, perhaps feeding this comic book, B, you know, Largo had just sort of bought this Dark Horse thing and they were like trying to do, I mean, I think they wanted this movie to, you know, be a more of a breakout than it was. I mean, it made some money, but let me give a little bit of context here for our listeners. In 1957, Evan Rendell, Larry Drake, flees after his father is lynched for killing multiple patients in his effort to find a replacement heart for his ailing wife. After 35 years, Evan escapes from a mental institution and returns to town for revenge, killing off residents one by one. When Jennifer, played by Holly Marie Combs, and her friends break into the Rendell house out of morbid curiosity, Evan notices Jennifer has a heart condition similar to his mother and decides to make her his final victim. Dr. Giggles opened on October 23rd, 1992 against Under Siege, The Last of the Mohicans, Candyman, The Mighty Ducks, and Consenting Adults. It would go on to make $8.4 million on a $7 million budget. It is 23% on Rotten Tomatoes from critics, 43% from audiences. Variety called it a wildly uneven horror film. That the film focuses too much on cheap laughs. New York Times said the screenplay is stitched together from variations on cliches used about the medical community. And then the Washington Post said Manny Coto turns to writer Graham Wilfer time and again in punchlines in a desperate attempt to revive a script that begins in critical condition and ends up DOA. However, Sight and Sound wrote that the film's satire gives way to a few nicely nasty moments. But that the film never tops the visual flair of its opening credits. I it's interesting because, like, obviously I'm assuming Candyman steals this thunder, right? Like, these were the two Halloween movies that came out.
Sure.
Candyman is superior.
Right. I mean, like, yes, but I also feel like Candyman is a serious horror movie for, like, serious horror people.
Correct.
And Dr. Giggles is a movie that you could like get stoned and go see with your friends and you might get more out of this than you would out of Candyman if you were like, you know, really high.
I agree with you. I mean, listen, Candyman only made $25 million. I mean, it's not like it, you know, but on an $8 million budget. But still, I think that your point is true, which is what kind of horror are you going for? Right? Right.
Yeah.
And I think that Candyman is a movie with, you know, some real people behind it, right? It's really not to take anything away from Manny Coto, but like this idea that Candyman has sort of real bones to it and has, it's like a real commentary on something. I don't think that Dr. Giggles is really a commentary on much.
No, I love that. I love the reviews kind of trying to contextualize it in some way. I mean, like, I think that if you really want to look at the like clearest line in terms of like Manny Coto's work, I mean, he did Tales from the Crypt. So like that feels like the easiest comparison here of like, it is basically horror comedy. Some of those episodes are funnier than others. Some of them are kind of more straight horror. They are often really scary and they are very gory, but you know, the Crypt Keeper is like a comic character, a comic book character and also a funny character. So, I mean, that feels like what we're going for here. I think that there is, because of that confusion throughout the movie, it's a little bit harder, I think, definitely for critics at the time to understand what it was trying to do. And you do have these moments like, you know, the moment where the child, Dr. Giggles, cuts himself out of his mother's corpse is like, that's like...
context for so people understand where that's coming from. The
I assume
father,
they've all seen it, I assume. I can't imagine Dr. not.
Basically, midway through the film, we realized that Dr. Giggle's father realized that he was a dead man. So he knew that he couldn't save his wife anymore. So he decided to hide his child inside the rotting corpse of his wife and essentially smuggle his son out of the house so that his son wasn't also killed. Although, like, are these people gonna kill the kid? But whatever.
You gotta go with it.
And you get a sequence, probably arguably one of the best sequences in the film, is a flashback sequence to our cop, our older gentleman that we've been following through this film, and a flashback to him being in the morgue when Dr. Giggles claws his way, tears his way out of his mother's dead corpse.
It's he's
giggling,
he's
the whole time.
he's reborn. He's like reborn covered in blood, but he's like a little boy. Yeah, I mean, that is like genuinely horrific. It's like also funny, but that's very gross. That's like it's very violent. It's more Cronenbergian than most of the other things in this movie. I just feel like, you know, I wish the movie were operating at that level the entire time. Because then it becomes more like or a trauma movie or something where it's like it is silly and campy, but it's also just like relentless and disgusting and a challenge for people to get through. And this is like a weird hybrid of all of these things that is a little bit harder to digest.
Yeah, I totally agree with you. You know, there are moments in this film that made me think about, you know, we covered Dead Alive / Brain Dead, the Peter Jackson film, earlier this month. And that movie, to your point, is full on, right? Like, that movie is going for it. You've got, you know, a man with a lawnmower tearing through zombies. Like, it's just an ocean of blood and gore. Very cartoonish at the same time, but still, like, fucking crazy horror, like babies tearing through people's faces and shit, like just crazy. This movie could have done that and would have been better off for it. And I think that, like, there's a lot of like, and I know you can't apply logic to a movie like Dr. Giggles, but there were a lot of moments in this film where I was just like, that child is not fitting inside that woman, right? Like,
well, maybe, I mean, if she were fully hollowed out beforehand,
even then, maybe. He's probably not that much smaller than she is.
I don't know. You got to go with it. I
yes, I'm just saying.
I think Brain Dead / Deadle. I mean, that's a great comparison too, because that's like a full on splatter movie that is funny. But like, for someone who is not into horror or violence, like, you couldn't watch that movie. And I feel like you could probably watch Dr. Giggles, you just look away at some key moments. It's not really asking that much of you as an audience member. Sure. I mean, I think you're right that they were going for something a little bit more mainstream. Sure. That, like, maybe by having this teen romance and just even having that kind of, it could just be a movie about Dr. Giggles, like, tearing his way through this town, but instead we have, like, you know, a final girl basically trying to make it more of a normal traditional horror movie, that maybe something gets lost and, like, you know, trying to kind of Frankenstein it into something that works.
I think there's also, and this could just be my brain, so forgive me, but, like, you know, as a person who, you know, ER, still one of my favorite shows, you know, I've tried to develop medical television shows. This movie does not adhere to any medical anything. So there's just times where I'm just like near the end of the film, he just has a bucket of hearts. He's just got just a bucket full of hearts. And he's just like, nope, that's too big. That's too small. And just like, so the only criteria here is size. And I don't think you can just keep hearts in a bucket. Like, there's just the obvious medical stuff in this movie where they're just like, they're playing so fast and loose, which is fun. Don't get me wrong. Right. But like, the movie literally opens with a man having it like splayed out on a surgical table in a full suit.
Well, he's that because he's that's like a doctor at the, or like that's a, you know, and someone working at the Institute Mental Hospital that he's like, you know, kidnapped.
Oh, sure. But you don't realize that at first.
No. You
so
don't
at first that. I'm just like, this seems like this is professional.
It seems like bad medicine. Yeah. Yes.
This is bad medicine.
I mean, I think it's interesting too, because part of it is just that it's like comic book logic. It's cartoon logic. It's silly. Part of it is that, like, Dr. Giggles is not actually like a surgeon, a heart surgeon. He is like, he's basically being his father, who's like, what, like a doctor who makes house calls. Like, it's very like old timey. Like, he has a little bag and he comes to you and he like, and that's, you know, that kind of contrasts with the actual doctors who are, you know, doing, or the doctors who try to do surgery on Holly Marie Combs at the end. I guess one of them does at the very end, but those are real doctors. Dr. Giggles is like the idea of a doctor from the late 50s,
right?
But he's evil and he giggles a lot.
It there's also some serious like Arrested Development going on, in the sense that he's basically just a child in a grown-up man's body. So like, to your point, he's like playing doctor, quote unquote, right? Like, he's just kind of mimicking what he saw his father do to some degree, and just giving us every possible medical pun and quip you could possibly
I love it.
Phenomenal,
because I mean that's comic book too, right? That's very like, especially, you know, we don't get that so much in comic book movies now, which is sad. We've lost something so precious. But obviously Batman and Robin is very, very pun heavy. Even like the Raimi Spider-Man movies, like I remember the first and second one at least, have their share of puns.
Totally.
And I think that's like, you know, it's fun. I do think it kind of contributes to the weird tonal issues this movie has.
Yeah.
But I think you're right about the Arrested Development part. There's also like, yeah, I mean, there's something really disturbing about kind of how he is this like weird child. The part also where he, I think one of the like the creepier elements or the creepier sort of moments in the movie is when he is stitching himself up while giggling and saying like that smarts. And it's like, because he's like a 50s doctor, but it's like, it is a little bit like gross. I mean, that it's just, it's hard to know what to do. I think that's why my vision for this movie, and if I were going to reboot Dr. Giggles, or if I were going to do a...
You mean when? No, not if.
Yeah, I mean, sadly, Larry Drake has passed, and I can't imagine who would take on that role.
Possibly fill his shoes, yeah.
But I think you gotta just really go for it and make it, like, disgusting and depraved, because there's no version of this that makes sense, or is, like, coherent, or is, like, you know, actually scary. So you just gotta make it, you know, disgusting.
Yeah, I mean, I think that, you know, it's worth sort of unpacking Manny Cotto's career a little bit, too, because he is a guy who, to your point, starts, you know, he does an Alfred Hitchcock Presents, he does Tales of the Crypt, he co-writes and directs this,
And then it's kind of, you know, it's Outer Limits. It's he works on Star Trek Enterprise, just 14 episodes of that, 27 episodes of 24, 10 episodes of Dexter. He's had a bunch of American Horror Story and American Horror Stories. You know, he unfortunately passed away recently from pancreatic cancer, which is obviously awful. But he really did make a name for himself in sort of the genre space of sort of, you know, clever, campy, kind of winky horror, which I don't say that in a bad way. And I do think that, like, you can draw a line between Dr. Giggles and Ryan Murphy's American Horror
Absolutely.
Story, for sure.
You Especially know what I mean? American Horror Story, American Horror Stories,
yes.
even more so, because yes. that's anthology horror and, like, makes maybe less sense than the yes. parent series, which is, like, tough to imagine, but actually, I mean, that show is, like, ridiculous. That is yes. silly. Yes. I think when it works best, it is what I'm talking about, where it's just, like, really, really going for it. Mm-hmm. Really, like, you know, pushing the boundaries of taste and, you know, ethics
logic.
And logic, absolutely. And I mean, like, and you know, Dexter was in many ways a more serious show
yes.
at one point, but certainly kind of became, you had to suspend a lot of disbelief to watch that show through the end, mm-hmm. as I did. Right to the lumberjack moment and beyond.
Lumberjack and beyond. I mean, American Horror Story is interesting because I don't know if you're watching Delicate, if you're watching this new season or not.
I'm letting it collect on my DVR until I, like, feel compelled to finish it or to start it.
It's reasonable.
There's
only 5 episodes in the first part, and then I think there's another 5 episodes that are coming because they didn't get to finish it.
Right, right. It's the thing that Chucky, the series, is doing where it's like they're calling it part one, and it's really like, maybe we should have waited until the strike was over, but sure.
And I will say that Delicate, it's interesting because I feel like all of this. So did you watch the Rachel Weisz Dead Ringers, the Amazon
yes.
show? Which
yeah.
I thought was great.
Great.
You know what I mean? Like, that is, I would say, the benchmark of what we're talking about here, of just, like, fully committed to an idea, being really smart about it, but also having fun with it and also grossing you out and doing, like, really crazy shit. Like, it's checking all the boxes, I think, that you want from a medical horror show, if that makes sense.
Yeah.
And Delicate, I mean, it just doesn't make any fucking sense. Like, you're just kind of
right.
watching, you're just like, I don't, and I know that, like, you know, my roommate's getting a kick out of Kim Kardashian being in it. And, like, there's it's the classic Ryan Murphy thing of, like, people will tune in because I got some pretty big names doing, you know, bonkers shit. I would argue that Dr. Giggles is more successful than Delicate is what I'm getting at right now.
Okay. I mean, I'm sure, I am sure that, you know, Manny Coto, sadly, if he were alive, I'm sure he would appreciate that. That
you're
kind of
thrilled.
Yeah. I think that American Horror Story, which I've watched from the beginning, mm-hmm. is, like, a ridiculous, ridiculous show. And I think that the worst thing it does, the worst seasons are boring. And I think that is, you know,
yes.
kind of occasionally attempting to have a point, to have, like, mm-hmm. a message of some sort is, like, what kills it. I think that what I really want, and why I gave up on American Horror Stories, because mm-hmm. it was just like, I want Tales from the Crypt. Like, I've seen every episode of that show.
Sure.
That is what I want. That is what, like, you know, anthology horror should look like. And that's, like, the right level of, like, of silly. I think that if I'm going to go, like, Dead Ringers was, there was humor in it and there was, like, stuff that made no sense, and that was fine. But it was like a prestige show. It was incredible. It was, like, so well written and acted and edited and directed. I mean, it was, like, a fantastic show. I don't know that there could be a Dead Ringers version of Dr. Giggles. I feel like the giggling alone kind of limits us here. I would like to see it. I mean, like, if there's, like, a feminist kind of, like, gender swap Dr. Giggles out there, I would absolutely watch all episodes of that series.
Sure.
But it feels like, you know, this was so comic book from the jump. Mm-hmm. That it was sort of like Tales from the Crypt was probably the best we could have hoped for with that.
I agree. Do you have a favorite season of American Horror Story?
I probably Asylum is the one that feels
okay.
the most successful to me. I feel like Coven, which people point to as being like, that's was where favorite. I was, yeah. I, that was where I was like, oh, they have no idea what they're doing, which was like always clear. But when they were like, I remember when it was like, oh, Stevie Nicks is into this, we should put her on the show, that I was like, oh, they're just like winging it. And this is just Ryan Murphy, like casting, playing with Barbies and like casting the people he wants to see on a show, which is fine. It's pure aesthetics. And I think that works to a point, but it's a lot, you know, there's no, I mean, it's, I watched all of Glee also, like you kind of just have to like accept that it's a clean slate every episode. You're not going to get any like coherent character development or plotting. Yeah. You just kind of like follow, you know, his whims. And I think Asylum was the most cohesive of the seasons, but even that had aliens and Frank, so I don't know.
This is what I like. For me, it's so funny because I vividly remember I was working at UTA at the time when the script for American Horror Story showed up. And I remember I read the script. One of the assistants gave me the script. I was like, why is it called American Horror Story? And she was like, oh, because like it's going to be a new thing every season. They wanted like a title that could be essentially like, I was like, oh, so anthology, that could be cool, whatever. That first season is pretty great in the sense of like setting the baseline for what it is. And I think ultimately my issue with Asylum, I tapped out around the Anne Frank revelation where just like, I don't think I can go on this ride.
Yeah.
And then the third season started and I was like, okay, now we're in full camp territory. Yeah. And I can fully commit.
Yeah.
To this,
I mean, I think it for me, it worked until it didn't. And I still sure. like, I would rewatch that over most of the seasons after
that's
that.
The thing, yeah.
I think Freak shows when I was like, I actually hate this show and I resent yeah. that, and I resent that I'm watching it. And I like,
yes,
I'm just like, it's so, it, and I kept watching. I mean, there are seasons where I was like, kind of like the Roanoke stuff. And when it became like the, you know, docu-series,
the show within the show.
Yeah. I mean, I was like, that was kind of fun. I don't, yeah, you know, yeah. But man, he cannot get out of his own way. And like, who am I to talk? He's extremely successful and gets sure. a blank check to do whatever he wants. So it's like, sure. you know, obviously it's working.
And you keep watching. So he's doing something
watching,
right.
Well, I'm not watching Delicate. So, you know,
not yet.
Not yet. And I don't watch American Horror Stories, but I feel like, yeah, I don't know. I feel like there's always this like element of greatness lurking in a Ryan Murphy project where I'm like frustrated sure. that it can't just be good. Because I really want it to just be good.
Well, it's, I did an episode of my Patreon, the double features thing, where I compared and contrasted the pilot of Glee and the pilot of Scream Queens with two writers. And we were sort of talking about how the potential of his shows or of just an episode. I mean, every time Nip Tuck starts, you have a patient come in and have a situation where I'm like, that's really interesting. And by the end of it, they've definitely pissed away that idea.
Right, right. I mean, like, Nip Tuck I enjoyed all the way through, even when it was terrible, because we didn't have that much, like, fucked up shit yeah. to watch on TV, yeah. where it was sort of novel how, like, it was every episode I was like, can they do that? Like, it felt very, like, shocking. And now that's like most shows. So I don't feel like, you know, there's nothing that's happening on American Horror Story that I'm particularly shocked by.
Absolutely.
And maybe yeah. I don't know if those shows exist anymore. In fact, like if those shows do exist, they could still shock me. I probably don't want to watch them. So I mean, Dead Ringers, some of it was pretty shocking actually.
Yeah.
But in a good way. Yeah, I don't know that like anything Ryan Murphy's doing is pushing the envelope in the same way anymore.
Yeah, I mean I think that I fully agree with you, and I think it's why every episode feels like a clean slate, because he's trying to, you know what I mean? Like he wants to try to outdo himself every week, right? Or he wants this show to keep pushing boundaries every week. And the problem is that, you know, I would argue that the one of the unfortunate things to come out of American Horror Story is burning through story so quickly. Same with Glee, where you're just like, it's, there's nowhere to go. Like you
right,
need
right.
to take your time with things.
Right.
And if you're just racing to get through to something else crazy, then there's just, it's exhausting.
We can go on a whole separate rant about this. I mean, I think that's a whole thing with streaming culture and yeah. content and trying to make sure people aren't going to, you know, ditch your show because of the slow yeah. burn. and they could watch something else. I think that's a lot of it too. But yeah, I miss when like things took time to develop, and yeah, and you know, I think that's why Dead Ringers like stands out, because it's like, you know, there's a lot of things happening, but it's a very deliberately paced show.
Absolutely. And I do think that, you know, to harken back to a time of Dr. Giggles and even sort of late 80s horror, you know, you had this kind of, I don't know, there was a playfulness, there was a people wanting to have fun, having a shock or a scream in a movie theater or what have you. And I guess that still exists today, but it feels like the movies now that are shocking people tend to be more of the A24 things than they tend to be, you know, the big studio things. I mean, I have some friends that went to see Exorcist Believer, you know, on the weekend, and were just like, left it. Yeah. It was like, this is just, don't do this. It does feel like horror continues to be very lucrative, because it's super cheap to make and tends to work out relatively well. I think that if Dr. Giggles came out today, or something akin to Dr. Giggles came out today, you know, if tomorrow Blumhouse decided they're doing a Dr. Giggles reboot, I think there's a way to do it. There's the A24 version of Dr. Giggles that I think actually connects.
Yeah, I mean, I think I get that. I think more of like the Shudder original version of Dr. Giggles, sure, where it's like, I mean, and because I watch a lot of horror comedy and I hate almost all of it, frankly. Like, I just feel like it's so, I don't know. I mean, it just doesn't ever capture anything that's like anywhere near Dead Alive, for example, yeah, to go back to yeah, that, where it's yeah, like, it's not scary enough, it's not funny enough, it's not shocking, it's just kind of there. And I don't know. I mean, I feel like most horror, this has been to me like not a great year for horror. I do my like best horror of the year list every year, and last year was an amazing year for horror. I was
what
like
was last year?
Last year, let me just kind of casually of course, Google that, because I have to whenever you Google best horror, on the things that come up are like the actual worst horror movies you can imagine.
Sure.
I'm just looking at this Rotten Tomatoes list now. What was on there? I'm scrolling. You can edit this out, or it's you're doing.
No. I'm trying to remember,
you know,
as well.
What did I like last year?
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/achieve today.
Everyone knows therapy is great for solving problems, but getting therapy has its own problems too, like finding the right therapist, fitting into their schedule, and of course, the cost. Well, BetterHelp can solve those problems. It's totally online and built around your schedule. It's surprisingly affordable too. Connect with a credentialed therapist by phone, video, or online chat, all from the comfort of your home. Visit BetterHelp.com to learn more and save 10% on your first month. That's BetterHelp, H-E-L-P.
The Night House I enjoyed. This was 2021. I was like, yes. This is two.
Well, 2022 is last year.
2020.
Right?
Yes. I just don't know what year we're in anymore. Last year was Barbarian, X, Scream, oh, Nope. There we go.
Wow.
Lots of like actual Crimes of the Future, which is like
love
not
that,
really
yeah,
horror, but horror adjacent. Mm-hmm. You know, there was a lot of really good shit last year. Even like mainstream like studio stuff like Smile, I thought was very scary, a little bit silly. Gosh, there was a lot. There was a lot last year. There was like
and
studio
this year
stuff
just, like,
and there
talk
was
to me is basically it.
This year is Talk to Me, which I haven't seen yet actually, so that could be up there. I've enjoyed some of the like franchise stuff this year. I really like Saw X. Or Saw 10.
Sure.
I enjoyed Evil Dead Rise. Mm-hmm. You know, we've gotten some, this is the year of like the weird experimental horror, like Skinamarink and the Outwaters. So we have kind of those. Mm-hmm. I had a great time at the Pope's Exorcist. That is I haven't seen Exorcist Believer yet, but I'm confident saying that the Pope's Exorcist is a much better movie and a much funnier movie. There's been some good stuff this year. There's been some good indie stuff and originals. Megan, Infinity Pool. Megan. There's definitely stuff this year, but last year there were so many like 5-star movies for me where I was like, this is like a really incredible horror year. And this year I've seen a lot where I'm like, I don't really get it. And I don't really, it feels overhyped to me, or it feels like I'm missing something. Once I could figure out what actually happened last year, I'm comfortable saying that yes, it was a better horror year than we're in now.
It is interesting because, you know, Kenny and I talked a lot about, obviously we talked a lot about 1999 and how bad a year it was for horror. I mean, you came on for Stigmata. We talked, which truly is like probably one of the higher points when it comes to horror in 99. The horror genre really goes through quite a lull through most of the 90s.
Right, right.
You know, the 80s is when all of these franchises are making significant amounts of money. Friday the 13th, Freddy, Halloween, all these movies, these horror franchises are doing really, really well. They're cheap to make and they make money. And then the 90s kind of come around and you have sort of these erotic thrillers that kind of take over in that space a little bit and make so much money. I mean, Basic Instinct makes almost $400 million. I mean, that is in 1992, like that's insane. So I think that kind of scratches that itch. And even just looking at 92 for horror films, you know, really it's like, it's Dr. Giggles, it's Sleepwalkers, it's, you know what I mean? Like The Lawnmower Man, sort of, kind of. I mean, it's a Stephen King adaptation, but still like...
It's not really a Stephen King adaptation, but right.
And it's just interesting because, like, you know, Emily, who obviously isn't on this episode with us, but is a big horror person and loves horror and was just like, there aren't really any to talk about in 92. And it is interesting because then right around the corner in 93 is Jurassic Park. And that's like fucking a game changer, right? It's not just a game changer technically, but it's a game changer because that becomes a style of horror that kids can go and see, and then you're off to the races, right? Like the whole 90s just becomes that. And then Scream changes the whole metric again in a few years, and that becomes the next. And we're still living in a post-Scream horror universe, I would argue.
Yeah, I mean, I think that it's interesting if you look at the 90s, because like if you look at movies from like a couple of years before Scream, they are so wildly different.
Sure.
Like that was a huge change in like what horror looked like and what horror could be that mm-hmm. like completely changed things. I think that there wasn't a lot of, we talk about sort of the slasher resurgence of the late 90s is a little bit like, if you actually look at it, there were only like a handful of actually decent movies that came out in that time, and it was like diminishing returns almost immediately. So that didn't last long, and then I feel like until you get to like Blair Witch, you don't really have like a new kind of thing to latch onto. Then you have like the era of found footage. I think right now it's like maybe we're in the era of like metaphor horror, which you could call like A24 horror, where it's like about trauma. lots of kind of like, you know, these sort of requels and franchise reboots that are thematically also about trauma. It's very feelings heavy, but I also feel like it's just, I don't know. I mean, it's not, I think it's more interesting to look at kind of like the horror of the time based on sort of what the societal concerns are like a couple of years prior, which is when like these movies got, you know, in development. And you can see, like, I remember it might've been last 2 years ago where there were a lot of Me Too horror movies where you could just tell that it was like, that was what we were going for. I think like eco horror is having a bit of a boom for obvious reasons, so there's that. But I don't know if it's like as easy to kind of pinpoint the era that we're in.
I agree with you. I guess what I meant when I say we're sort of still, the reason that I think Scream was this fulcrum point was because it was the moment when you could be self-aware. Like, I'm not suggesting that Dr. Giggles isn't self-aware. It is, but it's, you know,
he breaks the fourth wall.
Literally breaks the fourth wall at the end. But it's not like, I don't know. It's not the same thing, right?
Yeah.
The speech that, forgive me, I can't remember the character's name or the actor that the video store guy gives in Scream.
Randy.
Yeah, Randy, of course. That is iconic for so many reasons, but it's the game changer of being like, the movie knows it's a movie. I mean, God, I mean, Deadpool is still a fucking Scream
thing, right?
Like, it's all just sort of like, I know I'm in a movie thing. Mm-hmm. And I think that the, you know, the Robert Eggers and the Ari Asters are trying to kind of shake that off and try to get back to, not even like intellectually coming at these things, but just like stop being so winky. Like like, it's hard to be scared in a movie that's winky. And that's why I think this movie is also struggling to be scary.
Yeah. I mean, that's totally true. I think meta horror has continued. I think a lot of that's just because audiences are so much more savvy at this point that you kind of have to acknowledge what's going on, or maybe writers and directors feel like they have to. But we still have a movie I haven't watched it yet, but Totally Killer, the new movie.
Yeah, I'm excited for that. I'm
time travel, but that's a self-aware meta slasher.
Absolutely.
Trailer. It does look fun, but there are so many of them. I think it's like that's a lot of what is coming out now. It's like that, and then the kind of serious trauma indies. Sure. So yeah, that's like the mix.
Did you watch the, was it called Fear Street? Was that the triptych that came out on Netflix a few years ago?
I did watch Fear Street.
I watched the first two. I didn't get through the third one. I liked it. Like that felt like a relatively good mix of all the stuff, but maybe I'm wrong.
No, listen, I think a lot of people liked it. I did not care for those movies. The first one was like the best, but it wasn't great. And that one reminded me of Scary Stories to Tell in the Dark, which is like a very underrated PG-13 horror movie. Fear Street was like R-rated. I mean, it's Netflix, but it was like it had the violence of an R-rated horror movie. Sure. It didn't do much for me. I don't know. I mean, I really feel like there's been a ton of horror like every year. And I think it's just much more accessible now because we have things like Shudder, and it's like, it's a lot easier for like, there's always been a ton of indie horror, but now you can watch all of it, and something like Skinamarink can go viral.
Sure.
But I watch a lot, and I like a very small portion of that. But I'm grateful for the amount that there is. I mean, it's a good, in terms of like, if you look at the early 90s, for example, we certainly have many more options.
Yeah. And I have to say too, like, I'm just looking at like, the horror movies that have come out this year, just to like, cause like, you know, No One Will Save You, straight to video, right? Straight to streaming. Okay. You've got Pet Sematary Bloodlines, which is coming out. I have not seen it, obviously. You know,
I've heard it's terrible.
Yeah,
I've heard. But so. I also hate. I hated the reboot of Pet Sematary anyway. So, you know.
Sure, but like The Nun 2 made a shit ton of money. Here it's bad, but it made a boatload of money. The Boogeyman, which I haven't seen, but I heard was pretty decent, all things considered. You know, I don't think that Haunted Mansion counts, but
no.
But like, you know, Last Voyage of the Dementor, which some people really liked, it did very poorly. But like Insidious, number 5, is that where we're at?
Yeah,
I think it's 5.
The Red Door. Really well, yeah,
you know,
I didn't see it, but it was number 5,
right? And I mean, I liked the most recent Scream. Actually, was probably I liked it more than the previous Scream, for what that's worth. You know, I just think, you know, A Knock at the Cabin. Liked that. I don't know that it's considered horror necessarily.
I would call it a horror movie.
Okay, horror adjacent. I haven't seen Infinity Pool, but people seem to really like Infinity Pool. You know, Renfield, didn't see it, but I guess I don't know, man. I mean, like, it's a mixed bag this year for sure. I don't mean to suggest that it isn't, but I do think it's interesting that like a lot of fucking horror is coming out in theaters. Like, these are all the stuff that I mentioned there, for the most part, those are all theatrical releases.
Yeah. I think it's, and it, well, what's crazy is that, like, it's actually wild that there are still movies that are straight to Hulu or straight to Netflix when horror is so successful, yeah, box office wise that it feels nuts not to put it in theaters. I mean, you have like A24 with like Talk to Me is a huge hit, mm-hmm, and that is a tiny horror movie that, like, from Australia that, like, you know, should never have made that much. Like, great that it did, but that's a surprise. And those movies have, like, a long life in theaters. Word of mouth is good, and, you know.
People love seeing horror movies in the theater. They love sitting in a dark room with a bunch of strangers, feeling that tension, hearing the screams. It's the way to see a horror movie. Again,
right,
I'm a big scaredy cat. I don't do that. But there are people that do, and I get it. And, you know, I think there's something really interesting about studios weirdly embracing and pushing back on that, right? Like, there's some studios, A24, whoever, you know, I believe that Smile was supposed to go straight to streaming, and then they put that in theaters, if I'm not mistaken.
It was Paramount?
I think it was Paramount, yeah. And again, like, these movies cost basically nothing. You know, the real cost is in the marketing and actually, like, physically putting it in theaters. But, like, well worth it. So it is just interesting. I don't know that horror works as well on streaming, but
no, not at all. I mean, like, it just doesn't, it's not scary. You can get scared at home. There are movies that have done that for me, but, you know, mostly like a home invasion movie that you watch by yourself when you're at home. But for the most part, like, it's easy to not be scared. You could turn a light on, you can look at your phone, like, you know, unless you, like, give yourself a full theatrical experience, it's just not going to be as scary. And for someone who's easily startled like me, that is fine. But it's very different. And I can't imagine. I mean, looking at box office, I have to believe that studios will keep putting horror in theaters. And God knows we're getting, for some reason, an entire Exorcist trilogy. We can't escape that. It's happening. And I was reading about how they really want to, they want to reboot Friday the 13th, which feels like a no-brainer. They've been talking about doing Nightmare Forever, but that's harder because they tried it and it was a disaster. That's unless you have Robert Englund, who won't do it anymore, it's just not, it doesn't really work. Friday the 13th is easy to do.
That, I mean, they're trying to do Crystal Lake as a Peacock show.
That's right. Yeah.
We'll see if that ever happens as well. Excuse me. I'm with you. I don't know how you do Freddy without him, but then I'm just wondering whether or not you just have to, like, reinvent Freddy. Like, is there a way to
do it? Well, they tried, and their idea was, like, let's make him more of an explicit child molester. That's what the people want, is, like, a Freddy that makes them feel really dirty and bad.
I mean, that movie's also just, I mean, it's oddly nihilistic.
It's a nasty movie.
And it's misreading the original.
But, like, that's true of, like, all of the horror remakes of that era.
That's true.
That they are, like, they look like shit. I mean, at the time, I'm sure it looked great, but they're just, like, they're dark and ugly. And dark and ugly in a different way than things are dark and ugly now.
It was part of the whole, like, Michael Bay Platinum Dunes thing,
right,
they tried to do Texas Chainsaw, they tried to redo all these movies,
and some of them work. Yes, yeah. I think the Friday the 13th remake is, like, decent.
Sure.
The Texas Chainsaw Massacre one is, like, decent. Okay. The Hills Have Eyes remake is great. There's some good stuff in there, but Nightmare on Elm Street is not one of them. But it makes sense. I mean, I would listen. Like, I think Saw 10, whatever we're calling it,
yeah,
you know, being a hit. Like, I would love a Saw movie every year. We had that. We had a Saw movie every year. That's what I missed in my kind of thinking about horror, is the era of what they call torture porn, which is not really what Saw is, but I get
Hostel
it.
Hostel is that, though.
Yes, yeah, but Hostel has a point. Hostel 2 is a feminist reinvention of the Hostel series, but yes, I understand that is, yes, we got, like, kind of graphic violence. It's really kind of more like New French Extremity came over here, which is the kind of, like, extremely violent,
sure,
horrible to watch stuff that kind of trickled into the US. I think it was more kind of what the torture porn era was. But yeah, we got a Saw movie every year. And like, we haven't had that, you know, in the 80s, we had the same thing. We had a horror movie every year from these like franchises. Sure. Child's Play, there was like 8 months between two of those movies.
You know, it's funny. Child's Play, I did a double feature Patreon on that and Megan, which makes sense. Obviously, they're both, sure, you know, dolls. Child's Play is great. The first one's, yeah, great. I never saw any of the others, and I did not see the reboot of Child's Play with, oh my God, why am I drawing a blank on her name?
Aubrey Plaza
and, mm-hmm, Danny McBride.
There's never been a bad Child's Play movie.
Oh, okay.
So that's a great franchise. Okay. And the TV series is also great. Child's Play is a weird one because Don Mancini, aside from that reboot, which never went anywhere, yeah, Don Mancini has, you know, written and directed many of them, but written all of them since the beginning. So I think that
on. We seem to have lost our host. Let's just pause for a second here. And
looks like he's back. Yeah.
Yeah. We're back. Okay. just making sure. I agree with you that Child's Play is great, and I think it's great in the same way that Nightmare is great, which is that Chucky's a stinker.
Yeah. No, I mean, I'm always saying this. He is like, a little stinker.
The best.
Yeah, I just watched all the. I just rewatched all the Halloween movies.
Okay.
Which are fine, mostly. Yeah. They're not great. I'm watching Friday the 13th now.
Okay.
Those movies are not good. I don't think there's ever really been a good one.
But
think
it takes Manhattan. Come on, man.
Well, but he's on a ship for most of that movie. I just like, but they didn't have to be good, right? Because they cost, yeah, like $6, yeah, and there was no one in them. And like, it's, they basically like, they're like porn without the sex in terms of like how they were made and who was in them and like, totally, the quality we're going for. It didn't really matter. And I think if they wanted to pump out Saw movies, I would be delighted. I mean, Scream gave us Scream and Scream 6 1 year apart, but they're obviously pausing before the next one.
It needs to be said, for what it's worth, that like these Scream movies, $35 million is, that's relatively low budget in the greater scheme of things, right? And the movie made 170, so like they're laughing all the way to the bank. But to your point, Friday the 13th part, whatever the fuck, 5 or 6, or it was probably like nothing. It probably literally, yeah, cost them like $5 and a ham sandwich, and they, right, were thrilled if the thing made money, and it generally did. I mean, I would say probably the best allegory to that are the Paranormal Activity movies.
Yeah,
those movies cost nothing.
Right. Truly I could make one for sure. I just like set up a camera and
they make
wires.
Like, I'm looking this up right now because like I was talking about this with my friends the other night, because there are no less than 7 Paranormal,
yeah,
Activity,
yeah,
movies. Have you seen all of them?
No, I've seen like 2.5. I'm not really a fan. I think the first couple ones are definitely well done, but they're not really for me.
Yeah, I mean, I've seen none of them because, as I said, big baby. But like, I just to give you a sense of the 6th one, Paranormal Activity, The Ghost Dimension, that came out in 2015, had a, yeah, budget of $10 million, and it made $80 million.
Right.
And then,
right,
the last one, Paranormal Activity, Next of Kin, that went straight to streaming. So like, I mean,
yeah,
we don't know how much that made, but still, like, these movies cost nothing.
Yeah.
It's a joke, and they make so much money.
Yeah. I could see us kind of falling back into,
right,
franchises. It feels weird that we are not in that era now. And I think like,
I totally
agree. The rejection of The Exorcist, because like, that's not a franchise that you really want to treat that way. That's a, like, Exorcist is a perfect film that had some like shitty sequels. Yep. I mean, 3, yep, maybe less so, but not movies that people remember fondly. Mm-hmm. That you're then going to kind of like try to give the same, like, this sort of trauma based trilogy, sure, treatment to. It doesn't really make any sense. I think like, it's interesting because like Saw X is a more serious take on Saw in some ways. It is, yeah, like, it is very character driven. It is about John Kramer, and he is the main character.
I've never seen any of the Saw movies. Should I be watching,
well,
the Saw movies?
Yes and no.
okay.
It's sort of like when you start, it's just like, it's, I have like many. A love hate relationship. There are so, there are 10 famously. But I think that like, it's a Saw movie, but it is a little bit more serious. But I think if they make more of them, they're going to do what they did before, which is like you cast a bunch of random TV actors, no disrespect to TV actors, just what they're known for.
Sure.
And you just like kill them off creatively with like horrific Saw traps. There's also like a police procedural element that runs through these movies. It's like watching,
can I
like
a Saw question?
Yeah, for sure.
So like I'm thinking about watching the first Saw, right?
Yes.
Which is the first Saw the best Saw?
People disagree. I think the first two are good.
Okay.
Three is decent. Six is good. 10 is good.
Okay. So Spiral, not a fan.
No.
Jigsaw?
No, absolutely not. No.
It's so the reason that I asked the question is because As an avid listener of Blank Check, David Sims was rewatching all of the Saw movies. And I guess there's like, because they kill him. Like, Jigsaw dies.
In
so
Saw
then
3.
They have to like.
Well, he dies
like,
in.
Retroactively.
He dies in Saw 3. And then the rest of the series is all flashbacks. Or. takes place. It's like you kind of have to watch it to believe it, because it's like it's truly insane. Like they do flashbacks within flashbacks, like constantly. There's
it's
just
a
like
nesting doll of a series.
It's a wild, because they just keep retconning it to give excuses to right. You know, bring back these characters.
Sure.
And Saw 10 takes place between Saw and Saw 2.
Okay.
With the actors playing themselves, you know, 20 years ago, which is a real fun. I mean, it works because like you just go with it. It is ridiculous.
Sure.
But it makes more sense because it's like we know where that fits in the timeline. He was alive
right.
then. This is what he's doing. This is part of the story.
And it gets you back to the good times, right? It gets you back to like the ultimately the juice or what people want from the series.
Yeah, which is like John Kramer and Amanda. Like we want those two. And
those
that's
crazy
what it,
kids.
Those crazy kids. They kind of, I mean, they have a real relationship. You have to listen. You'll watch them.
I'm going to watch Saw. But you were speaking of flashbacks, so I wanted to talk for a second about the flashbacks in Dr. Giggles. Because
the movie we were here to talk about.
Because I do think that this movie has a bit of an odd structure as well, in the sense that you're kind of thrown in the deep end with it up top. And there's a part of me that I would argue that I don't know that I needed the hospital stuff at the top of it. Like, I know that what they were going for, which was like
right.
a big kind of hooky, you know, escaping from the facility kind of thing, but I don't know that it actually executes that particularly
so
well.
You didn't like when he held the fake arms and said he should have kept his hands to himself? Because I thought that
well,
was...
He uses the fake arms, first of all, to touch her appropriately.
Yes,
and then is like... So...
Yeah.
It isn't even that I dislike the fake arms. It's not even that I dislike the image, and it's a haunting image of like all the patients in the viewing
yeah.
gallery over the operating room. Like, there's interesting stuff there, but there's just a lot of like, we just want to get him out of here. Like, we don't really know how he gets out. We don't
yeah.
really know how this works. It all kind of just, it's a little kind of, you know, thrown together. But the flashbacks of where we learn about the backstory of the character and what have you is really late in the film for the most
part. It's very strange because it really would make more sense as like a prologue. Like there's really no reason to like tease it out because that mystery component is not really much of a mystery or anything that we care
right.
about.
That's the key.
Like, I think that if it were a comic book, I think we would get that pretty early on. Like,
sure.
that's his origin story. And then,
yeah.
but it's really kind of, like, portioned out in a bizarre way, where you're like, who, you know, you don't really know who the dad is at first, but you sort of get it. The only real reveal, I guess, is that he hid in his mother's corpse, which, you know, we love, but it's a late in the movie.
We stand a legend.
We do.
I mean, I think that... I as it was being doled out, or when it is doled out, which I think is honestly like 45 minutes into the film, maybe even later, you do find yourself going like, I've gone this long without knowing why this guy did this. I probably could have gone the entire movie.
I don't know that I'm entirely clear on the why beyond like revenge in a broad sense, which is like fine, but there isn't really like a reveal that makes me go, oh, I get it now. I understand his motivation because he doesn't really make sense as a character. I mean, he's sort of like a giggling man-child, sadistic killer doctor. Does he think he's helping people, or is he just trying to kill them? Or like, we don't really know.
Well, it's it comes back to sort of, I would argue that you can't even say like there are holes in this story, because that's not really what I'm getting at. But I do think the idea that the father killed a whole bunch of his patients in search of a heart that he could theoretically transplant it to his dying wife, that doesn't change the fact that he killed all sorts of people.
Right.
Like, there's this weird, and so you've got this idea that like Dr. Giggles is trying to get revenge on an unjust crime, but it wasn't an unjust crime, is my point. Right. Like, the father deserved to be punished for what he did.
Well, I don't think he's like playing an anti-hero. I think he is very much like, I think that's why they gave us Holly Marie Combs as like the heroine, and then we have like the antagonist of Dr. Giggles.
That's fair.
I think it's confused in the sense that it is a comic book story, but a lot of like comic book villains have a semi-tragic backstory. Like, didn't Mr. Freeze have the same sort of like, isn't it about his wife being, isn't she frozen?
She is frozen, and she has a disease that only diamonds can cure, or keep, or they can.
that's in Batman and Robin. I don't know if that's always been.
I don't know if that's canon or not. But she has a disease that he's trying to cure, which also happens to be the same disease that Alfred has in Batman and Robin.
Of course.
So they have to like, they, you know, they're working together. And then weirdly, in the middle of that movie, Schwarzenegger had a heart attack. So like, Dr. Freeze was supposed to die at the end of it, but he didn't want to die. Anyway, doesn't matter. You brought up Holly Marie Combs, which I think is worth talking about for a quick second, of Charmed and Picket Fences fame. She was also, I guess, in Pretty Little Liars as well.
The only one of those shows that I actually watched is PLL. another show that requires you to turn your brain off, because there are so many plot twists and retconning and absolute nonsense that you just kind of you gotta just turn it off.
Listen, those are two big shows. Charmed and Pretty Little Liars is no joke. People love Charmed. It just wasn't. I don't know. I never got into it, but there are people that love it. Interestingly, for this film, two other actresses both auditioned for the role of Jennifer. Jennifer Aniston and Ashley Judd both auditioned for this role. Both might have been better. I mean, this Holly's was fine, but
this was right before Leprechaun.
Correct.
Yeah.
It's 92.
So this is like, I love Jennifer Aniston in Leprechaun. I love her original nose. I think it adds a lot to her as a performer. I think that I can see that though. I mean, it's weird. The casting is, it feels very of its time, but it's also like not the A-list. Not that it would ever be that, but I think like as you get kind of later in the 90s, you get more TV stars who are like actual WB stars, which she was not at this point, because Charm was not till
98,
late 90s. If you watch any kind of teen slasher or whatever from the late 90s, you get actual WB, Tiger Beat, like you get those stars.
Absolutely.
And this is Holly Marie Combs and Glenn Quinn, who I guess was on Roseanne at the time, or maybe
he was starting his boyfriend, and he was great on that.
Yes, and RIP, he had a very troubled life. But it wasn't like the, you know, it wasn't top TV talent, or like, no. I don't know that they were drawing teens to the theater. I don't know if teens were like, I gotta go see Holly Marie Combs in this movie, or if people were like, I want to see the movie about the Doctor Who giggles.
I mean, I'm not even convinced that this movie it comes out October 92. I mean, Picket Fences probably premieres that fall, so like that's literally the first time anyone had ever seen her before. Do you know who was almost cast as the titular Dr. Giggles?
I don't.
Ted Danson.
I love that.
Can you imagine?
I mean,
if on hiatus from Cheers, he does Dr. Giggles.
I can see that. I mean, Ted Danson is in Creepshow, and I feel like Creepshow is another of those comic book horror, horror comedy things. I don't know. I mean, Larry Drake has such a distinctive, and I'm so sorry to his memory, like terrifying look. It's sort of easy to work with that. But if you look at that, the iconic poster, like it looks scarier because you think under that mask going to be some like more Ted Danson.
Yeah.
Well, I think it's more like he could be some Ted. I think it's scarier if it's like Ted Danson. I think it's scarier if it's some like handsome doctor looking person who happens to also be a killer.
I agree with you. I Ted Danson in this role would have been interesting. Like, I want to see that version.
Sure.
For sure.
Yeah.
Because there's something, first and foremost, America loves Ted Danson. He's in their, he's in their living room every week. He's Sam Malone. He's the nicest guy in the world, right? Like, Ted Danson radiates nothing but niceness and actually looks and feels like a doctor, right? Like, he seems like a guy that would be a general practitioner or whatever. Right. I would love to see a mad giggling scientist version of that. I think it's interesting, but I also, get why either he chose not to do it or they decided to go a different way.
Yeah. I mean, I think that this version of the movie would not work with Ted Danson. I mean, what's so weird about this movie and so many things, but like the giggling itself makes it so it can only be really silly, right? Like, there's no real reason why that character has to giggle. It could just be a killer doctor. It could be about, the title could be some play on hearts or something involving hearts.
Yeah.
There's no real reason for it, but they went with this, and that's why
it's
I wanted
a Joker vibe is ultimately what it's got, right?
Yeah, like yeah, for sure. But I do want to know more about how this came about and who first pitched it, because was it a Dark Horse writer who pitched this and then it became the movie? Like, it seems like that's more of where this came from.
It's the only logical explanation to it, ultimately. Like, and I don't say that disparagingly. I just think that it feels very comic booky. And then it feels like a horror, a somewhat campy horror writer came to it and was like, oh yeah, I can do something with this.
Right. And I mean, like, I think you're right. Like, the Joker is a great thing to bring up in terms of, like, there is a history of creepy laughing or smiling figures. There's, like, the man who laughs and the Joker in every iteration, and the gentleman on Buffy, and like there's lots of like creepy laughy smiling dudes. Giggling is a separate thing entirely. Like, no one is a creepy giggler. It's not, and it's like,
hard to argue with that.
No, I mean, like,
it's true.
It's just like very, but I don't know. There are like, the comic book stuff works in some senses. Like, there are certain like angles of shots and things that look like kind of the panel of the comic book where it's visually interesting. Sure. The whole like Hall of Mirrors sequence is sort of like, it's visually interesting. But I don't know that for the most part they get that much out of this being a comic book movie.
Not really. I mean, you really do just get a lot of kind of fucked up weird medical stuff. You've got like that sequence where he pumps the girlfriend's stomach with some sort of industrial engine.
Oh, he's like suctioning out all of the ice cream and then it turns bloody. That's a fun one. That's a gross thing. I mean, I like that.
Gross.
Yeah.
But it's well done. You mentioned the Hall of Mirrors thing, I think is great. All the condom stuff, that they really milk that shit for, like, they go way too
Absolutely. Long. Absolutely.
I'm just like, what are we doing here, man? It does lead to just, a great moment of Dr. Giggles in the bed saying, I hope you have protection. I mean, that is a good bit. I thought that, like, you kind of mentioned the Dr. Giggles performing the surgery on himself is a lot of fun. The doctor fight is fun, just in general. I think that, the crazy tools at the end, the her using, this is not how you could possibly use a defibrillator, but apparently you could put it in water.
But, Yeah, I mean, defibrillators in movies are used however it suits the plot. Like, that is classic horror. That is not, I have no problem with that.
Yeah.
And yeah, I mean, she really gets him. So, you know, I think there's like,
really get him.
That like, there's a lot, that chase sequence at the end and the whole, all of that like goes on for so long. It's a real, like, it sort of becomes like an action movie or more of a comic book movie where there's this whole showdown.
Yeah.
But there are some great
also like a subterranean hospital.
Well, I think that's actually one of the better
set pieces.
That, that whole the waiting room with all of his victims, like, that's sitting the there is very creepy. Yes. Yeah. Yeah, I don't know. There's got to be. I think there's enough here that we can point to and be like, that's kind of a cool idea or that's fun.
Yeah,
that indicates there's a version of this that might have been better. And like as it stands, I feel like it's worth seeing. It's like, you know, there's something you can't not see Dr. Giggles. I mean, I hope that anyone who hasn't seen it yet is going to go and rent it immediately.
First of all, it is currently free and streaming on Amazon Prime. So without.
Oh, is it? With that. So yeah. On Freevee. Mm-hmm.
On Freevee. But, you know, it's funny. When I pressed play on this, I went in, as you would imagine, with pretty low expectations. And I was pleasantly surprised by how entertained I was, all things considered. I mean, as we rate this movie, I obviously hadn't seen it before. I came into this podcast, I honestly gave it like a 57. Like, I was like, this movie's pretty solid. And I think I'm kind of around the same place. Like, I'd recommend people watch Dr. Giggles. You're going to have a good time. You're going to have solid, there's way worse ways to spend 90 minutes than with, you know, with the doctor. Obviously, you and I have our issues with it, just a lot of it just having to do with sort of the modulation of tone and what have you.
Yeah.
But like, more than anything, I want to say like a half hour into the movie, I was like, the concept and the conceit of this movie works. Like, it does. Now, I don't necessarily think that they totally hit it out of the park all the time, but I'm just like, a doctor, you know, using a doctor as a horror villain, kind of surprised we haven't seen more of that.
Yeah.
So, I mean, where were you? How would you rate this film?
Well, I think that for me, because the novelty, I saw it so recently, I think it was, I don't know, like 6 months ago. So watching it again, those tonal shifts and the teen stuff kind of dragged for me. And then it really becomes like, you really feel that more when you kind of know what's coming in terms of the kills.
Sure.
So I came into it probably like a 68.
Uh-huh.
And I think I fell to like a 61.
Okay. Yeah, but
I'd still recommend it. I mean, like, it's fun. I wish it were more fun. I wish it were grosser. I wish, like, I just think that there's, like I said, there's a version there that's better, and I think that makes it a little bit frustrating when you like when the gag is that he kills people with medical instruments in different ways every time, you just keep waiting for it to be
the next one. Yes.
But you also want it to be like a little bit more over the top, like really give it to me. And I feel like we do need a new Dr. Giggles, and I feel like maybe if this episode does numbers,
truth, it's interesting because, you know, Twitter's obviously whatever the fuck Twitter is now, but within the last like 2 years or so, there's been talk of Dr. Giggles. Like, people talk about this movie. Like, I do think that it's got a little bit of a cult following.
Yeah. Well, this is like, it had great VHS art, right? And this is the kind of movie that you would like, when you're a Blockbuster and you're like going through the horror like movies, this is something that you would absolutely gravitate toward. So I think a lot of people rented it when they were, you know, teens.
For sure. It's also one of those things where, I mean, as a kid, and I'm sure you have somewhat similar, I mean, obviously I'm older than you, but still, when you're in a video store, they tend to put up posters for horror movies. For what I remember Prom Night, I remember Dr. Giggles. There's just something about whoever works in these video stores understands like an arresting poster that's going to get people to remember it.
Yeah.
And that's one of the things that we've lost in a world of no video stores, where like that art was key to getting people to watch a thing. Yeah. We just don't have that.
And on streaming now, when you scroll through horror posters, they're so boring because they're just like, they're either it's algorithmically, it's like whoever they think you'll like in the movie, mm-hmm. or it's just like whatever generic bullshit. Like, you really miss out on, like, I used to love, way before I watched horror, I would like, that was like my challenge to myself, was to go to Blockbuster and like go through the videos, and like, if I dare to pick up a Nightmare on Elm Street movie, and like look at the back of the box, right. Which was so scary. I was like, this should not be legal. It's too terrifying. Or the Child's Play posters are incredible. Child's Play 2 with the Jack in the Box and so good.
You know which one I remember vividly as a kid was Ghoulies. Remember Ghoulies? Mm-hmm. The little guy coming out of the toilet. Just I was always thinking about that.
The big one for me was Dead Alive, actually.
Really?
Yeah. That was the one that I was like, what is this movie? This seems really scary.
Right.
But yeah, this feels like a movie that people watched when they were kids. I don't know what kind of run it got on cable, if anything, but
yeah. It does feel like a thing. You're probably right, a Shudder thing or something to that effect. But like there's some juice in Dr. Giggles. Like I think someone could come at this in a kind of American Horror Story way.
Yeah.
And make it connect.
Yeah, I'd love to know if Manny Coto had ever like had any aspirations of revisiting the character, because it feels like it, for someone who stayed in that genre, you know, throughout his career,
totally,
it just feels like a kind of a thing that should have happened. Maybe there was an American Horror Stories episode that could have been about Dr. Giggles.
It might have been,
because it does have that feel of many horror movies where it's like this maybe would work better as an hour-long anthology episode than as a full feature.
Sure.
But alas.
So in terms of jarring tonal shifts, the film that we're covering next week, Spike Lee's Malcolm X.
Uh-huh.
Do you have thoughts on Malcolm X? Have you seen Malcolm X?
I have seen Malcolm X. It's a great movie.
Yeah. It feels right. It feels right that it should be paired next week.
Absolutely. I think
film in November.
as if that movie hadn't suffered enough disrespect to be paired with this is like worse than Denzel not getting an Oscar. It's the fact that it's falling down. No, I think it's a fantastic movie. I remember I watched that in high school. I think it might have been, I took like a summer school film class for fun.
Sure.
As you do. And like,
sure.
That was when I like, that was great because it was like very much about like how I write a screenplay and that we like to make like 10-minute short films, whatever it was. Like, but we also had to watch like all these movies that are like, I don't know, they were just important to imagine. We watched like, you know, Chinatown and The Godfather and like all these movies that I never would have sought out until later in life had I not, you know. I think I watched Malcolm X for that.
We have Aaron Thomas came on to talk with us about it. Just an incredibly powerful movie. And you know, Aaron has such a sort of lovely personal attachment to it. And it's one of those films that I would argue, you know, the pinnacle of 92, you know, in terms of what it had to offer and how this film didn't, unfortunately, you know, get all the Oscar nominations that it deserved. We live in a world where Scent of a Woman has a Best Picture nomination over Malcolm X. It's just, I was so excited to, I bought the 4K Criterion. I was very excited to dive into that. What can be said about Malcolm X that hasn't been said, but I think we hopefully
you
do.
Found, yeah, you, yeah, you, I'm hoping but, you found some yeah, stuff, you know, a whole we, episode
we,
about
we,
it.
We've got a fair amount of stuff that needs to be said about it, but yeah, I mean, listen, I can't thank you enough for coming on to talk about Dr. Giggles with me. I mean, this was, you know.
I mean, I Larry Drake also didn't get an Oscar nomination. Oscar win. He didn't get anything.
He got very little love for this performance, but this was, you know, this was a movie that I'm thrilled that I finally watched. It's a weird movie that's existed in my brain since I was a kid and saw that poster. So I'm thrilled that I had the opportunity to watch it and unpack it with you. And I hope that you'll come back in the future.
Yeah, I mean, I'm going to look for the next Dr. Giggles level movie to talk about. So I'll be
find it.
92 Wikipedia page.
But where can people find you? Is there, you know?
You can find me on Letterboxd as Lewis Peitzman there. And then I am currently on X until it sort of died right before I came on the podcast. It crashed, but I think it's back now. I'm also Lewis Peitzman on there. Those are the main places. I do enjoy Letterboxd more. Obviously, there's limitations. Sure. I just talk about
sure.
the movies I watch there, but I watch a lot. So at least there is that.
Well, listen, I can't wait to have you back in the future for maybe even a movie better than Dr. Giggles. I know. I don't want to set the bar too
high. It's hard to top, yeah.
I mean, stay tuned in Dr. Giggles. You're really, you're carving out quite the lane for yourself.
I am scraping the bottom of the barrel, yes.
But honestly, thank you so much. I really appreciate it.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
All right, I'll talk to you later. Bye.
Bye.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. WarbyParker.com/covered.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
I'm Ina Garten. Welcome to Be My Guest, the podcast. One of the best gifts you can give friends is spending time together. But what's even better than that? Cooking with them. On Be My Guest, the podcast, new friends and old stop by my barn for some conversation and great cooking. We talk about food, life, and everything in between. Listen to Be My Guest, the podcast with me, Ina Garten, and join us wherever you get your podcasts.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.